Lower middle market businesses are a vastly underappreciated and undervalued space with tremendous potential for returns. Unfortunately, finding and acquiring a company can be tiring and filled with inefficiencies, wasted time, and ultimately dead ends. But our sponsor, PrivSource, grew out of the need to navigate through the chaotic waters of the lower middle market and help buyers source high-quality acquisition opportunities. PrivSource provides a fully vetted M&A deal platform with hundreds of live engagements thus far. Unlike other M&A platforms, PrivSource fully vets all members and deals to ensure they meet high-quality standards. They also never charge a referral or success fee on any deal that is sourced through the platform. The platform sources deals from a variety of industries and verticals, with coverage in the U.S. and Canadian markets. Deals range in size from $5 to $15 million in revenue and $1 to $5 million in EBITDA. If you're seeking to acquire and operate a lower middle market business and want to see more deals and pay less fees, check out PrivSource. As a listener of the podcast, you can save 50% off your first month by going to PrivSource.com/circle. That's PrivSource.com/circle. Welcome back to the Circle of Competence podcast. Tonight, Victor and I, our guest is John Wilson, the CEO of The Wilson Companies, which is a holding company for service-based businesses. And tonight, we're excited to jump into the operations side and how he's grown his business from buying his family out, his father out of his family service business, and now he's growing a portfolio of holding of service businesses and looking to expand. So we're excited to dig in. John, why don't you just start off, level set, and give us your backstory?
All right. Yeah. Thanks for the intro. That was pretty good. I'll try to live up to it. So my backstory is I think a little unconventional. I didn't come from a finance background, which I feel like that's where almost everybody comes from. So I was a technician, like a plumber, when I was 18, and I grew up in the family business, working around the shop and helping the guys. I ended up going to school for graphic design originally. Didn't end up working out for a variety of reasons. Switched over to accounting. And then in my early 20s, I started working on the business to try to grow it and scale it and just basically see what I could do with it. At the time, we were maybe 8 or 9 employees total, just about to hit $1 million in revenue. So very small, very moldable. And it was everything that Nick Huber says to go and compete against. You know, we had a fax machine that we were using every day. Like I don't think we had a computer program. we might've had QuickBooks, but that was it. I think even in 2015, we were still using like CB radio, like the trucking radio situation. So we were kind of a mess. So I spent the first couple of years working on that business and just trying to add best practices and through my efforts and then just really mainly the efforts of great team members, we were able to grow and grow fast, both organically and through acquisition.
What were some of those initial best practices and low-hanging fruit that you were able to attack?
The initial stuff was pricing model, getting rid of the fax machine. Honestly, that took about 6 months. That was like a lot of convincing. We went paperless. I think that took about 1.5 years. That took way longer than I thought it was going to take. Learning to market, I'm trying to think back. So I did this thing. I bought in late 2016 and early 2017. I did my then first State of the Wilson. It was like February. So it was like, here's all the stuff that we're going to be going through this year. And we've done it every year since. Now it's in April every year. I think this is our 5th year, but we basically just break down, hey guys, here's what's coming up. So I'm trying to think about what that first State of the Wilson was. I think it was like 5 people. Pricing model, going cloud-based, learning to market a little bit more, and I think working on HR practices. So those were the big 4 for the year.
Yeah, I guess I jumped in there a little quickly. Like I'm curious to know what did the business look like when you acquired it? And then what was kind of your initial maybe 90-day plan and 3-year plan?
So mine was a little different than what you probably normally see and talk to people because I one only acquired half. So that's an important distinction. And two, I had been working in the company prior. So that's an, both of those two things are unusual. So I didn't have to come in and do, hey, here's the first 90 days. Hey, I'm your new owner. You know, none of that had to happen because I had already been there for 8 years at that point. So most of my rapport was built. All of the hard stuff that you have to do on acquisitions, like the first 6 months is brutal when you buy a company. And I got to skip most of that because the previous owner was still there and the, everyone knew me. So I would say the first 90 days wasn't much different than the 90 days before it. I just happened to be an owner.
If now that you have had to go through that 6 month period, not being the owner and then closing on a new business, talk through that. And this is a selfish question, as you and I have briefly chatted about. I am in that situation and I'm really looking forward to getting to know folks and building rapport. I think one of my strengths is definitely relationships. But you know, I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. What does that look like for you?
I mean, I can talk about my deal. I think we should break down yours and maybe we talk about your implementation, right?
That'd be interesting.
That would be interesting. Let's do it. What do you got, Benton?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're closing May 3rd. It is a property management company that has 6 employees in the office and it has 8 technicians. So it's kind of 2 businesses wrapped into one. And what I have been trying to noodle over is I am admittedly a finance guy. Like you said, I come from sort of that background, very interested in the sort of the service, the intersection of services and real assets. My background's in real estate and real estate development. Just find that all of it sort of fascinating, how it all fits together. And but one, I'm not licensed. I would like to eventually. But then two, I think the bigger, at least my perception is the biggest hurdle is the relationships with the employees as well as the current landlords and the clients that they serve. Those are kind of the two biggest risks to me. Tell me if I'm wrong. Going into a service business where you don't know any of the people there. The way that I have this deal structured, though, is the owner is actually going to stay on for a year, up to a year, if we've mutually agreed up to a year to kind of help the transition go smoothly, which I'm excited about. It's definitely not traditional from what I've heard. That seems like a pretty long time period, but that was something that I kind of press for early on when we started talking about, hey, what would this look like? So that's kind of high level, you know. Certainly don't want to soak up any of the time, but that kind of sets the stage for you know, the question that I asked you, which is like, what is that first 90 days? What does it look like for the Wilson companies? Because, you know, I want to take that playbook and run with it too.
Yeah, well, let's like take my playbook, but like make it a little bit more relevant to you. So who's going to run the company? Like day one, who's the operator?
Day one, it's still going to be the seller, but you know, week in, week out, month in, month out, he's going to be transitioning all those roles and those responsibilities. So it's a small enough company that I'm buying somewhat of a job as well, if that makes sense, which I'm totally fine with because I'm not, you know, we're not taking outside capital. It's just not that big of a deal dollar wise. And so, you know, I'm definitely going to be the owner operator, if you will, you know, air quotes for those of you who are listening.
Are there other key people like managers in place, office manager, service manager? Who else are the key people?
There's the owner. There is sort of the dispatch sort of manager who also handles turnovers on the residential property management side. And then there are a couple of key sort of employees that handle like the main back office functions. And from a roles responsibility standpoint, I'm not 100% sure like what each and every person does for sure. I've gotten kind of the high level overview from the owner, but to me, it seems like he wears a lot of different hats, but he's got a few people that have distinct roles, whether they're, you know, mostly fielding the calls, the dispatch, you know, and he's got a guy that takes care of the work orders. And when I say like low hanging fruit, they send out paper invoices. And they dispatch paper work orders every day. So I'm excited about digging into your tech stack tonight.
Yeah, well, I think we can do that. All right. Well, I mean, it sounds like you've got good people on the team. the scary thing, I mean, you've already identified it, right? The scary thing is you buy a company and there's an exodus within the first couple months. I think from my perspective, I don't know what standard or not standard, but I've kept the seller on almost every deal that we've done.
In what role? Like an operator role?
In a manager role.
Okay.
So
do they roll equity?
No. So we break out operator and operating a little bit different. So operator is like, who's the, either the ops manager or the director of ops, depending on size of the company. And then we call the operating managers, like the service manager, the install manager. Maybe for you, it's, I don't know, the client success manager or something. It was 6 people in the office, 8 techs. Yeah. So we've never left a seller in the operator position yet. That said, I think I'm about to close on a deal, which we're about to do it for the first time. And I'm a little nervous about it. But I think it's going to be hard to, in your case, I'm just going to give you like, you know, unsolicited input here. It's going to be tough to switch someone who's used to paper and used to doing all that. That's a tough transition. So I would think hard about exactly what role that owner takes, because you don't normally want to change a lot when you buy a company. Like the first 6 months, if it's profitable, you're kind of just supposed to do no harm, right? Like you just go in there and just sort of like, hey, what's up? I'm Benton. Like I'm kind of here now. But you don't want to start switching over to, you know, tech if people are using paper.
Yeah, I'll let me jump in real quick. my first, I guess, 90 days is totally relationship focused. I think right now, I'm not intending to rock anybody's ships at all. I want it to be business as usual, and I want people to show up and know they have a job and know that, look, I'm just a regular guy. I'm here to help out, and I'm going to make sure that you have what you need to succeed. And I'm going to respect you and love you and support you. So I appreciate that advice. And that is something that multiple people have told me that, hey, don't be so quick to, like, you know, look for all the things that you can optimize, you know?
It's hard not to, honestly, because you go, especially with when, like, ridiculously low hanging fruit, it change management is tough because you got to get in there and you want to do all this stuff. Okay. So the other part of the playbook, what I look for when I'm doing a deal is what's my unfair advantage. Like, what can I do that maybe another buyer can't do? So I could probably do things with that company that you can't do, right? But there's also what's my unfair advantage over the current owner? So can I come in and can I dramatically change benefits, like, overnight? Because that would be a change that I would make overnight. Like, can I add 401k? Maybe they don't have one.
They actually have a 401k and healthcare.
I would be looking at comp then. So how can I dramatically increase comp? Like, I have 2 deals under LOI right now. And both of them, on day one, their technicians are getting, at a minimum, a $5 an hour raise. Like, I'm walking in there, hey, what's up? I'm John. Like, nice to meet you. Here's how your benefits work. By the way, you know, you're all making $10,000 more a year.
How does that make you feel that, like, you are basically, I don't want to say cutting into margin, but you know what I mean? Like, it is an investment into people.
Yeah, we gotta look at it like that. So I don't know how it would work with a property management arm. Like, are you doing outside work too, or is it just work inside your own?
So it's a very interesting business. They started out as a property management company. Well, they are a property management company, but they started their maintenance arm to service the property management company because they couldn't find enough, you know, good techs to do the work. And that arm of the business quickly outgrew just the property management company. And now it services a lot of commercial property and residential property outside of just the property management arm. So they're pretty much distinct, you know, entities. One is a subsidiary of the other, but they're pretty distinct.
All right. So there's this guy that I know in, I want to say Dallas, and he does this thing. He's plumbing an HVAC. I want to say $4 or $5 million a year in sales. And he does like home warranty work. It's not my favorite thing. The margins suck, whatever. Like, there's a whole lot going on there. But the beautiful part is the way home warranty work gets handled is the home warranty company will pay you. And if you mess up and there's a callback, they'll pay you to go back out and fix it. So that is training grounds. So he brings in junior techs and he puts them into this training ground. He has two or three at a time going through these home warranty companies. And then when they graduate to retail, which is the commercial and residential side, like normal customers. I wonder if you could do something like that.
For the property management company.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What happens is, like, those are two totally different personalities. The guy that's going to succeed at like coming to my house and trying to offer me a variety of services, potentially cross-sell or upsell or whatever, that's a totally different personality than the guy who's going to really succeed at just going and getting a job done at a rental property. And their comp should look different because the rental property margin repairs are probably much lower than the retail repairs. So I would figure out the comp strategy, because then on day one, it doesn't cut into margins. That was your concern, right? So I'm going in and I'm giving these guys a $5 an hour bump, not to buy their loyalty or not to do anything unusual, but just because the way my pricing model works is they are worth a minimum of $28 an hour. And right now they're getting paid 23. So if I'm going to buy their company, I'm going to put them on my pricing model and I'm going to put them on my comp model. So they just happen to be worth more to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That there's a lot there in terms of the flat rate pricing and the comp structure, but I want to keep drilling down on the comp structure. You tweeted out a few days ago that you love designing incentive structures. And one thing that I've been really trying to, you know, think about is incentives for these guys. They work really hard. And my goal in owning companies is to have everybody that works with me and that I work with, that we all share in the fruit of our labor, that the harder and the better that we do, the better that everybody else does. So I would love for you to just, you know, riff on that and share some thoughts on like some of the lessons that you've learned, maybe some hard lessons and some things that have also worked. You know, again, this is a selfish question, but I think this is really valuable for a lot of people in other industries as well.
Yeah. So I do enjoy it. First off, I think it's kind of fun. I think that compensation is a tool, and I think people get lazy with it and they just make a flat hourly or flat salary or something like that. But you can sort of dictate the growth of your company by just understanding comp. When our company really started unleashing, it was because we decentralized sales and then we figured out a comp system that worked in order to give people credit for those sales. Like they'd be able to get some of their own labor back, like you just described. But I think it's fun. So technicians is cool because there's just so many different models out there. Like there's straight commission or there's sold hours, straight hourly. Like the two companies I have under LOI, those are straight hourly, $22 an hour guys.
Yeah, the one that I'm trying to buy right now is they're all hourly based on it's a range, but it's based on how long they've been with the company and how much experience they have. But I don't know that there's necessarily any incentives in place.
Yeah. It's definitely tough to change a seniority structure because that's not ideal. Like it should be merit-based, productivity-based. So that could be dove into further, but so technicians, there's a million different ways, and it's almost the easiest one because you want to come up with a system that rewards techs and makes them a lot of money. Like the more money, the better. Like we cheer guys on when they break $50 an hour, because that's awesome. That's $100,000 a year. You're going to go buy a $100,000 pickup. Like you're going to do your thing. You're going to brag about where you work. And that's awesome. And like I'm helping to make someone else wealthy while they're making me wealthy, because that's how that works. Managers is way more difficult, especially the operator position, I think.
Before we get to managers, the manager position, I'd be curious if you're open to sharing more details on the tech side.
Oh, yeah, sure. I kind of breezed through it.
Yeah. No, I'm laser focused on this. I'm really interested in it. Yeah.
Let's do it. Okay. So there's a pile of ways in the industry to pay techs. That's the first place to start. Sold hours, commission, like a flat commission, contractor, and that's kind of a mix of commission and just like not W-2, Roto-Rooter usually does that. Hourly and then hourly plus incentive. So each one has its own benefits and each one has its own drawbacks. Anything that's straight commission, the drawback should be pretty straightforward. Like, you're going to grow your company super fast, but as you scale, you're going to lose control of the quality of techs you have, and people are going to get ripped off and it's going to be bad. So we have one guy who's on a hybrid of that, and it's just because we trust him a lot, but we still watch everything that goes on there because we're concerned about it.
And for those who are outside of the industry, is that because they're selling things that may or may not be actually needed by the customer just to generate more sales and more commission? It's kind of like a Wells Fargo type situation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
I think Wells Fargo, I'll ride on that a little bit, because I think Wells Fargo, people didn't really understand what they were doing, but it was just kind of like, hey, here's your goal. You got to hit it. So it's a little bit like that, but it's also, those people got base pay. Like, what people might not understand about like full franchise places, like the Mr. Rooters, the Roto-Rooters, all the Rooters, is these guys don't eat until they bring in a minimum sales amount per week. So zero compensation. And obviously that sucks, but it really misaligns incentives, because you've got someone who's got rent, he's got a mortgage, he has kids, right? He's got whatever he's got going on at home. And if he doesn't hit $4,000 or $5,000 a week in sales minimum, then he might only make $200, $300. And that's not enough to do anything. So really misaligned incentives. Yeah. You get bad behavior. You get people selling stuff for well more than it should be. You get people taking advantage of people. And like, maybe even just on a lesser scale, you just get a terrible experience because someone's trying to pressure you to buy something that you clearly don't need. Maybe you know you don't need, but you're probably never going to call that company again because you felt pressured and it wasn't a good experience. So that's full commission. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to make that work well. Sold hours is really interesting. Rich with Guarantee Plumbing does sold hours. I know a couple other companies that do it successfully. We use a hybrid of it.
Can you define that for the folks who may not know what that is?
Yeah. So the way plumbing and any skilled trade with materials is broken down is you have to hit X margin. So for plumbing, it's usually 55 to 60%. For HVAC, it's like 45 to 50. And gross margin is sales minus materials, equipment, whatever, minus labor, minus commission. So sold hours makes it so that people don't try to hit numbers, I'm doing air quotes for the listener out there, with a giant equipment sale that has almost no margin. So if someone is incentivized above $5,000 a week in sales, which is like the most common number in the industry, but they only hit $5,000 in sales because they sold a $4,000 piece of equipment, then that doesn't really serve the goals of what everyone's going for. So sold hours is most of our margin is baked into our labor. So the more hours that we sell, the more productive we are inside that truck. And you want to hit them 40% basically a week. So if someone works 40 hours a week, 16 hours a week is sort of the minimum that makes that truck productive, which sounds like absolutely ridiculous, I'm sure. Like that 40% productivity is like the target, but so much windshield time and there's a lot going on there. Yeah, that's sold out.
Do you typically use the hybrid, the hourly, like the base plus commission?
That's what we do. And it's not a commission thing. It's base plus sold hours bonus. And we like it because it's just a percentage basically, and they get a piece of their own performance back. And it's never reliant on one job, because that's the thing we always want to avoid. Like, we don't want someone going to somebody's house and like, oh man, I know I'll get $200 commission on this one thing. So I don't really like the idea of commission. I like the idea of goal with an incentive when you hit that goal, because I think it aligns what you're going for better.
Yeah. And it sort of tracks to the bottom line, not just the top line for the company, the overall company. Do you track that inside of Service Titan? Is that trackable inside? Okay. Okay. Well, we definitely need to get into the tech stack later on, but I won't keep you here. How about on the management side, on the operator side?
Well, real quick before we transition, John, are your technicians like essentially sales reps as well, in that they're cross-selling and upselling to customers?
That's a good question. Good question.
Yeah, for the most part. And anytime you're in retail, like their job is to offer options.
Mm-hmm.
So like we in HVAC, it gets really dicey. Like you just have to really train your guys well. You have to trust them and they have to earn the ability to offer equipment, because you just, that's a whole, you know, situation. Is if somebody goes in and is like, hey, your furnace is broken, and it's not, you know,
yeah.
One, like that ain't me. And two, like you're going to get a call from a lawyer. So takes a ton of training, but yeah, they do have pricing systems with them. So if they do actually find a bad furnace or a bad piece of equipment, they are able to offer that.
How do you manage that? Like the level of selling that they're doing? Like I'm kind of imagining like going to a car mechanic and, you know, they tell my wife, oh yeah, you know, your transistor's broken and all this different stuff. And then you take it to a different place and they're like, no, dude, you're good. Like this stuff's fine.
Yeah. So that's exactly the problem we are fortunately able to avoid. So we have, this is down to pricing system. So there's two components of sort of this problem. One is how are people incentivized and rewarded? Like what behavior creates a reward? And what pricing system is put in front of them. So you are usually able to not do that with how the pricing system is designed. Our guys don't really, they don't go in and sell. That's not the purpose of it. Like we've used the word sales because it's in, you know, it's easy to explain, but the purpose is usually education, and we just hand them the price book. I don't have one on me, otherwise I would show you guys. But it's an extremely transparent process where people just sort of pick whatever it is that they want to do, and you give them a few recommendations. But there's never, like in that case, you know, he told you, hey, you need to do this thing. That would not be something that would happen on our end. We would come in and say, hey, here's the 3 to 5 options that you have, from a Band-Aid to a Platinum, whatever. And you pick, you tell us. We're not here to sell you. We're just here to tell you what the options are.
Yeah. All flat rate prices.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it's a mix of those two things. So you have to create a pricing system that makes it so customers can just choose. Like you can advise them, you can inform them, but I'm not there to force anything down anybody's throat, because the last thing I want is an upset customer over a forced option or a perceived forced option. And usually if they do, because sometimes there's still a miscommunication or someone's still a little brash with an option, then we just give them all their money back, because it doesn't matter. We want happy customers. And then we just work with that tech, but it doesn't happen very often with us.
Yeah. We'll let's earmark flat rate pricing for later in the conversation, the company that I'm under LOI for, or under contract actually, technically, they use hourly rates. So flat hourly rate. So, and I've heard, and it's worked well for them, by the way, but I've just heard that, you know, in other situations and other folks have just advised against it. So we'll earmark that for later. But on the management side, for example, this next company that you're under contract to buy, you know, high level, how are you thinking about, from an operator standpoint, what those incentives look like?
So we, for the operator, the GM, we do cash flow incentives. So we have a base hurdle of cash flow that we expect. It's usually a percentage. And then once they cross that percentage, they get, I think it's 25%. It's a fairly significant portion of it. Achievable hurdle, I think it's 13% in the plumbing company. In our restoration company, it's 21%, because that's a very profitable business line, but very like, you know, up and down, like real peaks, real valleys.
When you say percentage, is this like a return on like the purchase price, like a free cash flow yield, or is this like a margin?
Like if I buy a company, or even in our existing company, so my existing company or the GM will have a base salary and then a goal to hit for cash flow. And when he hits that cash flow goal and surpasses it, he gets a percentage of the overage.
Oh, got it. So it's like a hard and fast cash flow hurdle.
Right.
Yeah. How do you adjust that over time? Or do you?
I don't know that we need to, because it's a percentage. And it depends on what phase they're in. Like if they're in growth phase, it has to be a lower percentage. So the plumbing company right now is in growth phase. So it would be unfair to my operator to set an unjumpable hurdle. But if they're sort of in just cash flow phase, which their remediation company is right now, then that's a pretty achievable hurdle. And we don't have to touch it until we decide to grow again.
What does growth mode mean for a services business?
Growth mode in the plumbing company right now is we went into the year looking to add 8 techs, which would be 30% growth in techs. So that growth obviously has to come from somewhere. It takes cash to do it. So that's 8 more trucks, you know, shelving systems, wraps, inventory, hiring, training periods, iPads, uniforms, sort of the whole thing. So those 8 techs will probably take us $180,000 to bring on.
One part of the very long tweet thread that we're sort of secretly working through right now was, I spoiled it, but was commercial leasing. Walk through sort of the economics of commercial leasing versus owning vehicles.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to shamelessly plug my podcast because we actually just talked about this too. So Owned and Operated, Lease First Owned. Check it out. Comes out next week. So leasing versus owning is a decision that everybody's got to make, right? And we chose it for a variety of reasons that fit our needs at that time. That said, I suspect in another 5 years, we will move to ownership. So to me, I see it as a phase. It's just what works in that moment. So we got onto it because we had 15 vehicles. We had Wilson Plumbing, and I had just acquired a company just south of us that had a very old fleet. Like the youngest was 7 years old. The oldest was 20 something years old. So like old fleet, tons of maintenance. And our maintenance jumped from like $2,000 a month to $10,000 a month overnight. So what we're dealing with at that time is probably 12 vehicles that had to turn in about a year. And the maintenance was just totally awful, not just from the actual cost, $120,000 a year. At the time, we were like $2.5 million. So that's a big chunk of money. But the opportunity cost and the downtime of people having to swap vans and, you know, do everything because we had another broken down van almost every day. So at the time, we're looking ahead at the next couple of years and we're like, man, we're probably going to acquire again. So what does our balance sheet need to look like to acquire again? And it needs to look good. So let's not go take out $400,000 of vehicle loans. So that was the first like, okay, I think we'll look into leasing. The other attractions are pretty obvious. Like we're dealing with $120,000 a year of maintenance at that time. It was pretty attractive to go to, hey, we'll give you a van, brand new, off the lot, we'll shelve it, wrap it, and you churn that thing at 5 years, and there's unlimited mileage, and there's unlimited wear and tear, and it's $400 a month. Like, sign me up. And all I have to do to get that vehicle is send an email and it's on my lot within 2 weeks. So that was really where we got into leasing, is we sort of fell into it because we felt like we knew what the next couple of years looked like. And then we really liked it a lot once we got used to it operationally.
How much do those trucks cost to purchase?
Usually, because it's through a lease program, I think they would be $35,000 if I went out and bought the truck that we were buying. Through the lease program, they're maybe $27,000 or $28,000.
Okay, dumb question. Why is it cheaper to do through the lease program?
it's enterprise. So they have like enterprise level negotiating, and usually they order it direct from factory. So like we'll go and there's no dealers, there's no middle anything. Like when we get it, it got out of the factory a week before. And so we get them at like three or four at a time.
Got it. Well, if I think I'm missing something here, but if it's cheaper for the leasing to do the leasing, like what's the benefit of owning the trucks?
That's where we're at right now, is we're looking ahead at the next couple of years and we're just deciding what do we want to do. So I think that there's going to be a point, and I honestly don't know what the point is, because we just reopened this conversation like a week ago. But it's at what point does our annual leasing bill, how many trucks could I buy with that same bill? And right. At what point does that sort of like even out? And there has to be a peak. We're just not sure when it is. So right now we spend $120,000 a year on leasing. So that's all of our lease fees. And we're like, okay, so 5 years down the line, maybe there's $1 million or $2 million of cash flow in the trade companies. There's a lot. So there's enough there to handle the CapEx. Maybe we're not trying to aggressively grow as much, so we don't mind spending the cash on that and just creating more free cash flow instead of lease payments. And maybe we can buy 5 or 6 vehicles a year and end up spending less than we would have on the lease. And the honest answer is I really don't know. So that's the conversation that we just started opening up. And that was my argument. But even with that argument, I don't know that I'm right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd like to kind of zoom out and just kind of talk about the Wilson companies as a whole. So obviously I've followed your Twitter along. You're prolific on Twitter, and I love, you know,
oh boy,
following you there. And I love you guys' website and looking at the companies that you've acquired over the years. So can you talk to me about, like, you know, the holding company level, the various companies you've acquired, how they're integrated together, and then maybe some of like the shared services?
Yeah. So we're in that process right now. Just in January 1st, I stepped back along with 3 other team members into the shared services company. So that's a brand new portion of our business.
And we did that. Mint?
That's Mint. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So we did that in preparation for a couple deals this year, but also because it became easier just to manage the remediation, real estate, and the plumbing company from a shared services level. So the 3 verticals that we're in right now are plumbing, damage remediation, and commercial real estate. So the shared services that we're offering are financial, HR, marketing, and strategy. We're probably going to bring call center in there. You guys talked to the guy from Griffin Brothers, which was just awesome.
Mike Griffin.
Awesome episode. Like, that was such a great episode. I loved everything about it. So they're doing call center right now, and it's a good idea. We hadn't thought of it very much until a few weeks ago. And as we were prepping to integrate 1 or 2 deals, we're like, man, it would just be easier to do call center. So we're going to be shoving that into shared services too.
Did you say marketing?
Marketing. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So this year is a sort of on the shared services subject. I'm probably the smallest of your guests so far, as in we have not fully hit scale yet. So we'll be hitting scale this year, which is pretty exciting. I mean, that's that's awesome. So what scale looks like to us is a full HR director inside the shared services company, a full CFO inside the shared services company, and a marketing director inside the shared services company. So we're missing those 3 roles right now, and we're sharing them between a few people, but we're getting ready to onboard an HR director as we prepare to bring on 34 employees.
Wow. That's a lot of employees.
Yeah. What will that bring you up to?
I literally have 35 employees right now.
Wow. Yeah.
So yeah. That's a double, my friend.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So we see scale at 8 to 10 million in sales a year. So we're going to be just over 10, somewhere between 10 and 12 as a whole group with both these deals.
When you say like we'll hit scale at that point, what does like hitting scale actually mean?
Scale to me means that I can execute on what I was hoping to do when I built this all out like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like what I wanted to be able to do was go start a company and be able to immediately throw an operator at it and have all the back end that I needed to, that all we needed was someone to do operations and integration. Or the same thing with an acquisition. Like I want to be able to acquire a company 3 or 4 hours away and have an integration team and have everything back office. That way that company only needs to know how to do their operations. So that scale to us is the ability to just execute on that vision.
Is that operator, I mean, do you expect or have they been previously someone who was at the company previously or there when you acquired, or is someone you would bring in?
We'd be bringing in, we started to incubate operators last year though.
Very cool.
So right now I have one person on the bench that's going to jump in with one of these deals. And we just hired a second person to put on the bench because we're going to, you know, put the first bench person into play in the next couple months.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. So it's like an entrepreneur in training or?
Yeah, that's what it is now. When we first started it, it was more like, I think I'm going to acquire something next year. Not very scientific. And when I have a feeling that I'm going to want to double, and that is honestly as scientific as it gets, like I wish it was more analytical, but it's not. I'm like, yeah, you know, I need a project. Then I start to staff up in preparation. So last year in end of quarter four, I knew that I was going to pull myself back into shared services and that my role at that time would be to build the company while other people ran the various verticals. So I knew I needed to go buy something to be useful. So I brought on an operator and basically just had her work in a variety of different roles, biz dev and service management and shadowing current GMs.
Okay. With that, I think it'd be an amazing segue to hiring and retaining employees. So I work at a tech startup, and honestly, I think like all things considered, it's a pretty easy place and space to hire people because it's like very shiny, very exciting, tech funding, PR.
I've got a story about this before we go any further.
Yeah, well, you've got to tell it.
So my buddy, his name is Bill. Bill, I love you if you're listening to this, but he started a tech startup like 3 or 4 years ago. He ended up selling. It was cool. But this, this mother, he would go to like almost any given place. I mean, anywhere. He'd be like, yeah, I run a tech startup. And then like 15 people would be like, dude, can I just intern for free? Like no pay. I'll do it for 3 years. No problem. I'll fully code out everything you need. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like I have to pay people $100,000 to want to give a shit about the trades. And like you have 15 interns. Like this is not even fair.
I mean, exactly. So like in the service space, how do you attract and hire and retain great employees, especially the attracting and hiring? Like, I feel like, you know, you obviously are a good guy and you've built a good company. I feel like once you're there, it's, you know, I can see being good at retaining them, but how do you attract and hire them in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, everybody says it's hard and it is. So it's just like, if you're buying a company, what's my advantage? So you need an advantage. So you're different than everyone else. For us, we use compensation as an advantage. We use hours as a big advantage. So like breaking both of those down a little bit further, if someone worked in a normal retail, I'm going to use franchises. I'm not trying to pick on them, but they tend to burn guys out. Like those guys might make $130,000 to $200,000 as a plumber. Like that's not unheard of, but they're working 100 hours a week to do it. They might have off one day a week. Like it's just, it sucks. So that's not a hard, you know, the money's great, but that's not a hard thing to recruit against because our guys literally work like an average of 41 hours a week and they make 80 to 100. Like, and they get all their nights, all their weekends. Like there's no on-call, there's no emergency, there's no whatever. So it's just coming up with what's your superpower for what can you offer these guys that other people can't.
Yeah. when you say there's no on-call, no emergency, what would you guys do in a situation where a customer calls and said, you know, I have a terrible leak, I need a plumber ASAP?
Sometimes we just don't take it. And yeah, sometimes we have guys that are willing to take it because they want overtime. Like some guys want work, some guys want to work 50 hours a week, and that's cool. But I think the choice is, or the big thing is that we give them the choice to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just sitting here thinking, those guys working for the retail brands, working 100 hours a week, getting, you know, really, really tough conditions, long hours. And I'm reading headlines about Goldman analysts sitting at their desk complaining about their hours.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy. Like, you get into these franchise plumbing situations, and these guys really are, they're working 100 hours a week. That's like a normal story that we hear during interviews.
That is
I have worked 7 days a week for the last 8 months. I'd like to see my family. The money's great, but I'd like to see my family. Like, that's the typical story.
I was just looking at this headline that my friend sent me the other day. So I interned at this bank called Moelis, and they're like an infamous sweatshop in New York. And they gave them the investment bankers a $10,000 allowance while, quote, encouraging workers to take time for themselves on Friday nights into Saturday at noon.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's crazy. So I think you just identify, hey, you know, what's valuable to people. And for us, it's a lot of little things. So one, we are nice people. I think I'm a nice guy. And we really hire managers that have servant leadership is the big thing that we're aiming for in managers, because people don't tend to leave jobs, they leave managers. So we look for people that really fit what we're looking for. And that's a super important hire. The new truck thing helps. And like, guys don't want to be seen driving around in these 20-year-old beaters that look like they're barely hanging on. So the brand new, hey, I'll put you in a 2021. This thing's like literally got out of the factory 3 weeks ago and shipped here. It's pretty attractive.
Sure.
And then on top of, hey, there's no on-call, you can see your family. And by the way, top industry wages. So it's not a hard sell. Usually if we're able to get a hold of guys for a conversation, then we're able to recruit them. The tough part is getting hold of them.
Mm-hmm. Having like a holding company and shared services there, and then these kind of different verticals. If, let's say, a plumber is not on a job, but it's a Tuesday at 10 a.m., is he in the office?
Honestly, I would have to check with the Brandon on that. My suspicion is that, like, if there's absolutely nothing that day, then he doesn't come in. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Or if he like does one or two calls, but he finishes up early. I believe there's a minimum time, but I don't really get that granular into operations.
Yeah, this is kind of like a low level and tactical question. I'm just curious, or was curious, like, if, you know, if they're spending time in the office, or if they can kind of like, quote unquote, work remotely until they're called to a job.
I mean, for the most part, there's not much office time to do. So okay. our job as, or I guess not really my job, but someone's job is to manage payroll as efficiently as possible. And we have metrics we have to hit. Mike Griffin talked about it, right? You got to hit that 20% labor. That's our metric. I don't remember what his was, but for us, we have to hit 20% labor. So if guys are just sitting around doing nothing, sort of waiting, then that's, you know, not great. Usually they get sent home. I don't know what time the sort of hurdle is. Like, if there's nothing by X time, you get sent home. We used to, when we were very small, be able to keep guys on for like, hey, we'll always give you 20 hours during the winter or something like that. But we're just not able to do that now with the size of payroll we have and the size of company we are. So what happens now is every quarter one, when we get slow, we go through and we sort of lean out some of the techs that just aren't fitting the culture, maybe bad attitude or, you know, whatever. It's just sort of a culture cleansing. And that helps keep the guys that are remaining, you know, working full time.
You hit on a couple metrics there, but I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into the KPIs that you sort of track and are most important to you, both on the plumbing side and on the restoration side. It's funny. I feel like you are, you're in the shadow of Mike, and, you know, his business model is basically landfills plus everything that you guys do. So just would love to kind of compare notes and hear the KPIs that you guys track.
Yeah, it is actually funny because, when I first heard that episode, I sent it to our operator and I was like, dude, this might be us in like 5 years.
I hope so. He's crushing it.
We're moving down all the same verticals. I have two deals under contract right now. One of them's a septic, and then I'm going to roll up another septic and then a wastewater facility. And that's like exactly like what this guy's doing. So it was kind of funny. And now I don't remember the question.
What KPIs do you guys track in both service businesses?
Yeah. So the big ones are pretty much all the same. We have a DME, it's the Daily Management Essentials meeting every day at 3:30. I'm pulling up the report right now. And we go over the same 8 KPIs every single day. And we know where we're trending. And if something's not good or is great, then we can sort of work on it. So total service calls. So that's calls in. So inbound call volume is a really big deal, right? Like you need X amount of calls at X conversion rate to accomplish your goals and keep your guys busy. Work performed, like how many jobs were callbacks, how many jobs were club walkthroughs, or just no charge for whatever reason. So that's a tough metric. Daily sales, that one's just pretty straightforward. Average invoice is pretty straightforward. And then labor. So what percentage of labor is field and what percentage of labor is office? And we have different KPIs for each.
When you say what percentage of labor is office versus field, dig into that.
For our model, field has to be 20% and office has to be less than 10.
Is that a capacity utilization percentage? Or is that like a margin on the revenue?
It does a couple things. For tech side, that's gross profit. So if you're in the same verticals, like plumbing materials are 18%, like almost hell or high water. That's what it always is averaged out. If it's higher than 18.5 or something, we start really diving into like what happened. HVAC is 21, I think, because there's just equipment and more stuff going on there. So the tech labor, that's the controllable gross profit number. So is our tech labor 20%? Awesome. Is it 30%? What's going on? Maybe it's a low sales volume day. Maybe the work performed metric was super low. Maybe we sold things badly. I mean, maybe we just did a bad job at doing what we were supposed to. The office metric is, are we appropriately staffed? So if you get too lean, like if we are running at 5% office, then we probably need to hire people because we're understaffed. We're not able to serve our customers the best way we can, or we're not serving our techs the best way we can. And if we're over 10%, then we have too many people and we got lazy. And we started just hiring people in to do jobs that maybe we could have consolidated.
Are those like daily sort of snapshot figures, or are they trending?
It's daily. So every day we know exactly what our payroll is. We know what our sales are. And that, like, it sounds not that complicated, but that is like, that is a difficult thing in a trade business to get right every day. That took us, I think, 5 months to develop that to work the way we needed it to get daily payroll and daily sales. Like, it was complicated, mainly using ServiceTitan, but how installs work, which is like an equipment install, it might be multi-day. So then you have to figure out how to break out labor over a couple of days. You have to figure out how to do install sales over a few days. So getting it down to daily was tough, but I recommend it. Like if there's a problem, you can identify it really quick. We were able to pivot our business extremely fast in COVID because our business dropped 30% overnight, and we were able to watch it drop 30% overnight. So there was no like, oh, what happened last month? No, what happened yesterday and what can we do? So it really saved our business.
So like this DME meeting at 3:30, all the metrics look good. And let's say your inbound call volume for that day is way down. Mm-hmm. What's like your first thought about attacking that problem?
Depends on how down.
Let's say 30 to 50%.
All right. That's pretty chunky. So 30 to 50%, that's usually like a red, you know, that's like a red alert. That's not a red flag. Call center is down. What the heck's going on? So yeah, call center's down. So we're going to go check for bodies. Like, you know, we're going to go look for some stuff. Usually we have a couple, we call them like the emergency. It's like the button. So yeah, we have a couple times every year. It's the red button. So that happens like once or twice a year where we have to press the red button, which is a large mass discount that when that thing starts trending down, you can sort of hit one of those two or three large red buttons and drive call volume and fill up a schedule for like a month.
How would that be done through marketing efforts?
Yeah, usually I'm going to plug a Service Titan because Service Titan has all of your data aggregated. It's very easy to communicate with all of your customers within about 5 minutes. So if we're identifying that call volume, I mean, we know call volume by 10 a.m. for the day and where we're trending. So if something is going bad, we act fast.
Yeah, Benton, I know you want to dig into Service Titan, so I think now would be a perfect time.
I was just about to say this is a perfect segue into as we continue down the tweet thread of how to grow the service business to 5 million. Check it out. It's a great tweet thread. But you basically said if you're on any other software platform or not using a software platform, then you're doing the wrong thing. So tell us why. Tell us why. And we ought to be getting like a kickback from Service Titan.
I think John has equity in Service.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder.
So, okay. So this is kind of funny. I said the same thing in January because I threw out that thread and then like Service Titan got like 20 leads and I was like, bro.
Yeah. Give me some cash.
I hope you got a discount on your monthly subscription.
We ended up getting like an affiliate thing, which was pretty cool. I honestly didn't know that existed and it did. That was kind of cool. So Service Titan, here's the deal. You're going to buy this company and they're on paper. So you're probably already looking at software companies, right? All right. How many have you talked to?
Jobber, Service Titan, and what's the other one?
And Help Desk. And
really the only two that I looked at were Jobber and Service Titan. There's another one that I briefly looked at, but didn't really, it was pretty much a pass. So those were the two that I was recommending.
What was the price difference?
Significant. And that's what I was like, whoa.
Right. So that's where most people stop. So here's the thing. I have talked to so many people and they only ever have one thing to say after they talk to Service Titan. Whoa, that was expensive. Like that's the only thing. Not, oh my God, that's going to revolution my business. Oh, wow. Like look at everything that we can add in and suddenly streamline and like get rid of two jobs and be more profitable. Like the only thing is, wow, that was a little bit more expensive than the other one. So I think like, yeah, it is. Like, yeah. I spend $50,000 a year on software, but you can literally do anything with it. And we've tried all the other big ones. Like we've tried Jobber, we've tried Field Edge, we've tried QuickBooks. And then when we first started, we were just on a whiteboard. Like we've done all the things and they're all terrible. Like all of them are really, really bad. They usually have no reporting like at all, or maybe they have like one report and it's like gives you sales, but it doesn't give you sold hours. It doesn't give you average ticket. It doesn't give you timesheets. It doesn't give you anything that you actually need to run a growing business. So no reporting, really bad plugins. So like Service Titan, I'm just like annoyed that I'm not like getting like a monthly check from them right now, but like it is good. I, you know, it is what it is. So
I'm going to, by the way, I'm going to tag them this is a mental note. I'm going to tag them in the Twitter post so that
we need to get them as a sponsor.
Yeah. I've tried. It's difficult, but, so the plugins are another big one and the new integrations that they're constantly coming out with. So we used to use MailChimp separately and now Service Titan has its own marketing integration that is frankly much better at what we need to do than MailChimp. Like MailChimp's amazing, no doubt, but for a home service specific niche, Service Titan knocked it out of the park. and I can communicate with my 15,000 emails in under 5 minutes for those red alert days, right? And then you can, because it's linked in with your CRM, you can do automatic quote follow-ups. You can do automatic everything. You don't have to send postcards anymore, like the dentist, like, hey, it's time for your checkup. Because we do that for backflows and furnaces, ACs. You don't have to do that anymore because it's all automatic because the email system is linked up to your CRM. The marketing integration is nuts. Like we have like 1,000 phone numbers, probably literally. And you can track everything that came in through that phone number or that email or that lead source all the way down to the net profit dollar. We hooked up our GPS system through it. So every truck is now, like that's timesheets now, is our GPS system that is linked up to ServiceTitan. So there's like multiple levels of integration there. We're finishing getting our warehouse linked up through it. Like it does the whole thing, and it has strong reporting. Because I think some of the other ones like Jobber, Field Edge, they have all these different modules, but the reporting part, like that's the whole game, is you need to know what's going on in your business every single day, because you need to know what's going to go on tomorrow. And you need to, like, if you don't have a fast feedback loop, you can't improve.
Yeah, that's really valuable information, I'm sure. I have a buddy that let me sort of test drive his dashboard in ServiceTitan, and I was pretty blown away. And I don't know that he's actually totally, not figured out, but is yet sort of integrated it into his inventory system, like you just mentioned. I would be kind of curious how that works on the warehousing side.
Well, we linked it up to our barcode software. Wow. So that's like, it's an open API, so you can sort of hook up what you need to hook up. So we have a separate barcode software for our, you know, little laser gun things. And when guys use parts off a truck, it automatically pulls a report off ServiceTitan at the end of every day. Our warehouse picker, it integrates into the warehouse software. So he sees that, pulls the report, goes out and, you know, guns the warehouse.
So a plumbing and HVAC and electrical company is all paper, and it has a small handful of techs. What is it going to take from an investment standpoint, cash as well as time, to integrate this into that company?
It's going to take years. And that's depending on how fast you're trying to grow. Because our problem was we were always growing while doing this. So we're trying to integrate change while we're adding 20% to our workforce every year. Which actually might end up being easier because then you could train quicker. But yeah, it takes a couple of years. And that's just change management. And if you do it any faster, then you'll probably lose people.
When you rolled out the software initially, like, was it like one iPad at a time, or was it everybody and sort of like piecemeal paper plus digital invoices? Like what did it actually look like in practice?
So when we very first went cloud-based, there was 4 technicians. So that was not complicated to roll out. You know, now there's 20 something. So changes now are very difficult and expensive to roll out. But at the time we took, it was 2 straight work weeks. And it was just from 7 to 8:30 every day we trained on the iPad. And that was it. It took maybe a month of videos to prep beforehand. We integrated pricing into it because that's a good time to add pricing is when you're already adding new technology. And really that's like the first thing that we do when we acquire companies is what does pricing look like? Because you're gonna have to pay for the changes that come.
Well, Victor, do you have any other questions?
I do. John, you kind of mentioned to us earlier that you guys are planning to do an equity raise.
Oh, I'm interested in doing it. So okay. I've never thought very seriously about it. Ever. and it's just really only in the past few months that I'm like, okay.
You needed another project.
I need another project. I mean, I'm going to be honest. That's part of it. So, I think it's interesting to figure stuff out. So right now it's me. Like I own the stuff. And I'm 29. I have no need or reason to keep doing this. I don't need to go raise money. I don't have investors I have to pay off. I don't even have like SBA loans that need done. They're all seller finance. So like I'm in a comfortable position. That said, like, you want to do stuff, otherwise you get bored and you never keep getting better and figuring out how to level up. So raising a fund to me genuinely just sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I want to know what that feels like. I want to know what it feels like to raise $10 million and go take down maybe just one giant deal or a couple small ones and roll them up. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. You think they'd be in similar verticals or verticals that are tangential that you'd roll into the holdco?
I think so. I think that we're pretty comfortable getting up to about $100 million in sales in the trades. Above that, I think there's just other things you could be doing, like maybe some vertical integration. I think that'd be cool. I just think there's a lot more that you can do, but $100 million feels like a good number. So we'd probably continue acquiring inside the trades in other cities and taking down bigger targets.
If you don't mind me asking, how long do you think it would take you to get to $100 million in sales?
That's a good question. Probably 15 years, 10 to 15 yeah. years. Because again, if I keep doing what I'm doing, which is using my own profits to roll forward and right. buy other companies or start other companies, you can only move as fast as you can move. That said, I'm not accountable to anybody, which is super nice. sure. And I can lose money. Like if I have an idea that I'm like, hey, I feel good about this idea, I don't have to check with anybody before I lose my own money. And like, that's cool. I would be scared to lose someone else's money.
That was going to be sort of the follow-up question to the equity raises, you know, basically why are you considering it? I think it would be awesome to have a special set of partners that are aligned on the vision and are okay with kind of a permanent hold, like longer term hold model, and are just looking for like long-term dividends and they want to invest in a good operator. But because of what you just said, if that limited your freedom, you know, to kind of, you know, follow maybe some curiosities or maybe do some investing outside of sort of the core groups that you've invested in thus far, you know, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I agree. And that's why I've never thought that hard about it. Like once you're not beholden to anybody, it's sort of hard to envision it any other way.
Yeah.
So I think it's come up more recently because I have our deal funnel has worked like very well.
Yeah.
Way beyond my expectations of how many conversations I've been able to have. Right now I have two deals under LOI and I have three staged for next year. And we're like the funnel is still open. So there could be a lot more conversations that happen. So that's why I've started to really think about raising just in the past year or two, because I have all these targets that, oh man, we won't have the SBA bandwidth to do that.
Yeah.
And what else do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Just to soak up the capacity.
John, you seem to have just unbelievable deal flow. So what's the secret? What's your sourcing strategy?
It's unbelievable. So cap target, right? I've tweeted about them a ton. They're the best. It is awesome.
Really?
Yeah. Have you guys talked to either of them?
Is that like a business brokerage site?
It's just captarget.com and it is okay. Literally an off market business like finder. You give them your parameters. I needed 10 things to, so it was revenue, employee size, years in business, online reviews, and geo. So maybe it was only 5 things. And and industries and the various niches inside those industries. And then they just print out a list. And they email that list incessantly until they get a response or after 6 touches. And that is the whole game. And I've had 60 conversations since middle of January.
Whoa.
Is it like a monthly fee thing?
Yeah, I paid them up front, but yeah.
Yeah.
It was a $1,500 or $2,000 a month.
Wow, that's incredible.
But for me, it was like if I do, you know.
If you do one deal.
If you do one deal, literally one deal. Wow. And then you get to keep all your data. You get to keep those connections. Like now I know these owners, you know, we started reaching out to Columbus because I want to buy in Columbus next year. And now I have 5 active conversations with owners that are thinking about exiting next year. So that's just going to keep rolling.
Yeah. Does CapTarget, I mean, they must have like a, I don't want to say proprietary, but just a really good system or method for getting in touch with owners and getting them to respond as opposed to just like a general broker might?
It is honestly just email. So I think it's where they get their data that must be the more valuable component, because they're the hard part is finding companies, right? Like I could Google Plumbers Akron and pull a whole list and send emails. I have no idea what their revenues are. I have no idea employees. I have no idea number of owners and their names. And I definitely don't have their personal cells and emails, right? So that's what this service does, is it gets you direct to owner to have that conversation. Because over the years, I've tried letters, I've tried phone calls, I've tried a ton of different things. And probably 50 to 60% of the time you get gatekeeped. Like, hey, I want to talk to the owner. Like the office manager's not going to let you through. Right. And then you can't say to buy the business, right? Like that's not going to get you through to the owner. It's the communication. I think it's wherever they get their data from, and then they just communicate through email.
Okay. I've got a selfish question here.
Yeah.
So I am going to business school in the fall, and I'm going to go for 2 years. My goal is the overall reason I'm going to business school is just my wife and I have both grown up in Atlanta, went to UGA, spent all of our time here. We just wanted an opportunity to go somewhere for 2 years and meet some cool people.
Sounds fun.
I feel like I'm always justifying the MBA to everyone. But I really like, my ultimate goal is to walk out of Chapel Hill in May of 2023 with a business under contract. So like first year, you know, I might be doing some like light searching, but really we'll just be like getting my head on my shoulders and situated there. Second year, I want to be like searching full time. I'd love to hear just your take on what I should be doing over those 2 years, you know, especially second year, and I'll just kind of, you know, leave that open floor to you.
Yeah. I'm super into that. I think, I'm not trying to keep doing this, but I am going to plug Owned and Operated. So my GM, Brandon, he is so impressive. Like it is nuts, but he started this company when he was 16. It was a landscaping company, very lowbrow, and he ran it full time all the way through high school. Like he started at 16 all the way through college full time. Like he was running a business, and then he sold his business to a competitor at like 20. And then ran his competitor's $2 million a year landscaping company for 3 more years while he finished graduating school. So like, if I were you, that's what I would be aiming for, because I know when I was doing accounting classes at like 21 or something. And I was also working on integrating best practices. Maybe it was 23, a little bit later, doesn't matter. I was working on integrating best practices inside that company, and being able to go to school at night, 4 or 5 nights a week, and learn how to do this. And then literally 8 a.m. the next day, you're integrating what you learned last night. That was amazing. Like that was awesome. And I think we got our feet underneath us so much quicker because I understood so much more live. Like I had a live test subject to experiment with while learning. So I would try to buy that thing while you're in school.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Or maybe even start something.
Yeah. I think you've probably got the capacity. It's nice when you buy something. A lot of different thoughts on this probably, but when you buy something, you don't have to reinvent everything, and then you could just go in and tweak. So that's cool. And I think that I would not be a good 0 to 2 person. Like I would not be a good startup person. For a variety of reasons, but I think that I've done very well so far from 2 to 5. And I think that I would do well there. I am a little intimidated about 6 to 10, but I think that buying just gives you a head start and you can go in and optimize and directly take what you're learning and integrate, versus if you had to launch, you would not be doing that. You'd be boots on the ground. Like I know a guy that just launched what's probably going to be a very successful truck-based business. It's like remote oil changes for fleets. We use them now for our fleet. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. We love it. That said, he didn't get in there to be changing the oil. Like that's not why he started that business, but because he started it, he's the guy changing the oil for the next probably 2 or 3 years while he tries to figure out scale and model. So that's the downside of starting.
Yeah. I guess the only wrinkle to throw in the fold would be that, I really want to buy a business here in Atlanta. So operating it, you know, starting to operate it while in North Carolina. I mean,
I don't know. I know, I mean, I know guys that do it.
Yeah.
And even in my industry, and it's not because of COVID. I know a guy that lives in Kentucky and he runs a, I think it's a 1.5 million. It's not like huge, 3-4 techs, but he, like, that business is here where I live and he's a state and a half away.
And yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just, I guess, who's how big is it? Who's operating? Who's in charge of day to day? Do you trust them? And how good is your technology?
I actually do have one thing I think would be interesting to dive into. And that's just transferring wealth to future generations. So
I have some Twitter opinions on this.
Okay. All right, good. I thought that was you. I mean,
yeah,
I would love for you to just riff on this.
So I'm going to start with, I don't know what the right way is. Like, I'm not here to tell anybody what's right or what's wrong. I really don't. I think that generational wealth scares me a lot, because if we're looking at my specific trajectory of wealth, I'm 29 and I'm at this point worth more than what I need to be worth at 29. We make more than what we need. And I really enjoy new projects. So I can only assume that with my track record so far, that I will continue to operate conservatively and continue to be more wealthy as time goes on. So when you're in an intergenerational family business, you can't help but think, when I bought into the company at 25, it was achievable. This was a $1 million a year, 8-employee company. I could go in and integrate change and I could do things, because it's sort of a blank canvas and also small enough that if I did harm, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. Whereas if I'm looking, you know, I have 2 kids, one's 8 months and one's 2.5. By the time that they're 25, how on earth could they possibly be able to have that same opportunity that I had? And if I do give them an opportunity, it feels like nepotism, where someone's been super faithful for like a decade and then I like shove my kid in front of them as a manager. Like, I just don't see how it ends well. So that's from my own perspective. And then I know a lot of people, and obviously people think that maybe this is raising, and like, I hope it is, but I just know a lot of families that have been torn apart by, wealth. Like, I have someone at work, their dad built just an empire, a real estate empire. It's something that like real estate Twitter would only dream of, right? It was incredible. And this was like 30 years ago. He died 25 years ago. And the kids were all handed these assets. And as adults, like 30, 40-year-old adults, like already formed, productive, had jobs. It's not like they were handed $30 million at 5, you know, like they were adults. And they had good relationships, and suddenly all of their lives just unraveled because they're making $500 to $1 million a year doing nothing. So like at 55 years old, some of these guys are playing video games because they literally don't know what to do with their life. Because if they go get a job for $100,000 a year, and they're getting paid $1 million a year to do nothing, like how do you justify that time? Right. So, and now 25 years after the dad died, they're liquidating the entire portfolio because none of them can talk to each other anymore. And that's one of like 10 examples that I know that wealth has just destroyed families.
Yeah. So like, obviously thoughts on this kind of serious and philosophical stuff evolve and iterate over time. But, you know, based on your current perspective, you know, 10 years down the line, let's say something horrific happened, you passed away. You know, what do you want to leave behind financially to your children?
Right now, the way our trust and estate is written is that they get everything. When they turn 35 and it starts at 25, they start to get increments and the companies are liquidated. Like, there's a plan in place, but in my heart of hearts, I don't like it. You know, I want to be able to give my kids an opportunity somehow. I mean, everybody wants that for their kids.
Yeah.
Right. They want their kids to be able to be productive and find happiness and whatever that is. But I just don't know that finding happiness involves being handed tens of millions of dollars. Like, mm-hmm. That sounds like hell.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I mean, a lot of the funds in the journey of, you know, building right. that for yourself.
Right. I mean, you get to discover yourself and you get to discover your strengths and maybe most importantly, your weaknesses. And you get to figure out if you can handle that money. Like, I think that when I'm where I'm going, I'll know that I can handle it because I've built up to it with the people around me. But how could someone just receive that? And I think you can be a parent and do all that stuff that other people say. I don't know. I mean, I think my stance on Twitter was I'll change my opinion when the facts change. Like if you show me a bunch of families that this worked super well for and they came in and there was no weird nepotism and the kids were able to just smoothly move in and maybe either buy the company or they inherited it and handled it well, I would love to hear it because honestly, this weighs on me.
Yeah. Hey, John, I tend to agree with you that like, just the natural order of things is such that it's good to have people sort of earn their keep, you know, that's just kind of my personal take, right, wrong or otherwise. But, I actually just finished a biography of Gerald Hines. He's like a really prolific real estate developer. His son actually ended up, you know, going to Harvard Business School, getting his MBA and then coming in and just like, you know, at whatever young age, becoming a project manager. And he kind of worked up, but it was obvious that he was going to take over, you know, a multi-billion dollar global company, right? And apparently it went off without a hitch. Now, I don't know their family's dynamics and, you know, he was remarried, you know, once. And so I don't know kind of their whole history, but that was one interesting example that, you know, apparently it went off pretty well. One of the guests that I also had on the podcast, Shirin Kanji, I have a lot of respect for Shirin. He shared some high level details of how their family's sort of like real estate. I don't want to misspeak, but I think it was in the form of basically like a trust that, you know, the family's not able to effectively, you know, destroy the principal value of it, but they're also not going to get rich based off of the dividends that it pays out. And you sort of work, you have to work for the company to sort of earn into it, if that makes sense.
Go ahead.
All I was going to say is, just to get back to your earlier points on incentives, I think there are interesting, potentially creative ways to sort of align incentives of like...
Nice segue back.
Circled
that right back in.
That's right. To align people's motivations to sort of have to work somewhat hard, even though that they sort of know what's at the end of the race anyways. You know, but I do agree. I've seen other families where it just, you know, they had all the money in the world and it didn't do much for the second generation. So
yeah. Well, for us, it's hard to pin in my, because I'm a third generation family business owner, but am I the first? Because it's a different level. And I really don't know what the answer is to that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough. I think about it often because I know that if we continue down the path that we're continuing, the way that everything's written, the estate is written, if I die tomorrow, like there's a plan, then my son at 2.5, like I need to start grooming. And that just, I don't know, it feels kind of weird. Like I don't want to rob this kid's childhood. And I don't know. Like if anyone out there is listening, can you find me on Twitter and DM me about how to do it right? Cause I'm scared to death of it, honestly.
Yeah. Well, there's a shameless plug. Before we're not going to ask all of the final questions because we've been here for almost an hour and a half and this has been an unbelievably great conversation, but I did want to give you, 2 to 3 minutes to sort of reach the audience and just say what you're looking for, what you're in need of either personally or professionally, you know, just get your message out there.
Yeah, I think if I'm thinking of what I need personally and probably professionally, I have struggled for a long time to find people that are one or two steps ahead of me. So I've had conversations with a lot of different people that are 4 and 5 steps ahead of me, but not many people that are just right in front of me. Like, what decisions did you make here? What decisions did you make here? Third generation family business, but it's, you know, anything that any problem that I'm dealing with now is unlike anything that anyone in my support structure knows how to deal with.
Right.
So, I mean, even just this personal, like, what do you do with your wealth when you die? Like that's a big personal thing. I'd love to know what other people who are a step or two ahead of me are thinking about it and how they're going to handle it. For professional, it's sort of the same thing. Like, we're looking at going multi-location. I'd love to talk to people that have gone multi-location and have run remote businesses and know how to solve my current real estate problem in the smoothest way possible, right? So I'm looking for people that are a few steps ahead of me that can just have conversation and, you know, be giving, and I'll try to be giving back.
Well, I'll ask one of the final questions that we normally ask in the effort to keep time short. What is one potential business that hasn't been started but needs to be? And another way to sort of ask that question is, you know, what's a pain point that if you could snap your fingers and it was solved tomorrow, what would that be?
I should have prepped for this one.
It's a hard question.
Yeah.
It's also 9 o'clock PM Eastern.
Mm-hmm. I think it would, I hate how simple this is, but I think a better version of recruiting for the trades.
Mm.
And I think people have tried it from so many different angles that that's sort of like a worn out request. But I still think we're dealing with the same problem where people aren't attracted to it, or they don't understand the potential. And I think that there should be something there where, I mean, we have 28-year-olds making $110,000 a year with no student loans, and they bought their first house at 22. Like, that is what dreams are made of, right? Like, that's a six-figure salary that's owning your home. That's awesome. And he works 40 hours a week and gets to spend time with his kids. And like, that's what the trade hold for people, but it's still sort of masked in this weird trade school union, like go to, I don't know. I don't know what the fit is there, but some sort of educational business to create a top of funnel awareness for what the trades are really like and what they really look like for your family.
Yeah. A Lambda school for the trades.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it needs to be a school. It's more like, hey, this is what's out there. Cause again, yeah, I don't,
like marketing. Like,
yeah. Just like what I just said, I don't think that the average 23-year-old would ever know that you could do, or 18-year-old, like, hey, do you want to make over $100,000 before you're 30, own your home and have no student loans? Everyone would say yes to that. Right.
I've got one in my home county. They are putting kids through a community college program to be like utility linemen, and they're making $80,000 to start.
Yeah.
That's 80 grand.
Right. That's a thing. Like, we start apprentices at like 40, and within 2 years, they're making above 80, like within 2 years.
Wow.
So college is four and you have to pay for it. You get paid to learn in the trades, $40,000 a year, which, like, you know, eat some ramen or something, you're going to be fine. And then you'll make 80 to 100 and something dollars a year. Like, that's insane. And like, people just are not aware of that ridiculous potential out there. So I think that's the business I would go with. It's probably top of funnel, purely marketing or awareness. I don't know how you would charge for it, but I think that it would help make the world a better place.
Yeah. I love that. Well, that's a perfect way to wrap up. John Wilson, this was a phenomenal. This is a great conversation. Thanks for coming on and spending time. And
yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. It was fun.
We will publish this soon, and best of luck to you.
This is Benton here again. Thanks so much for listening to the Circle of Competence podcast. To find more episodes like this one, go to circleofcompetence.co. That's circleofcompetence.co to sign up for my weekly podcast emails, as well as a monthly summary of links to blog posts and articles I liked most from the previous month. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating on iTunes, which will help more people discover the work we are doing to explore the entrepreneurial investor's journey. Thanks again for listening.